International Diplomatic Student Association is a Hungary-based organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSAA podcast aims to educate listeners on career opportunities for university students in Hungary, opening their minds to current socio-political issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPPER Radio.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the next episode of the IDSA podcast, an exclusive project launched by the International Diplomatic Student Association. My name is Simon, and my co-host is Paolo, and today we'll have the honor to talk to Mr. David Morris, the Vice Chair of the UN Asia Pacific Sustainable Network, and also a Research Fellow at the Corvinus University of Budapest. Thank you, Mr. Morris, for making the time and agreeing to talk to us today.
Well, hello Simon, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, before we start with anything, could you please give an audience a brief introduction about you and your work?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I'm a local in many respects because I've been living here in the beautiful city of Budapest for the last 4 years. And I also lived here when I was young, in my mid-20s, a long time ago. And so I'm kind of returning to like a second home. But of course, as you can probably tell from my accent, my home country is Australia.
Yeah, true.
And I've also worked and lived in a number of other countries. So most recently, I spent some time as a diplomat in China. I've worked as a diplomat here in Hungary at the end of the Cold War a long time ago. And I've also lived in Ireland and the UK. And a long time ago, I've also spent quite a lot of time in the United States. So I guess I'm a citizen of the world.
That's a very long CV you have there.
A very impressive list. So, as far as we know, you used to serve under the Australian government as a diplomat. From your point of view, how has the world changed from when you were still serving?
Oh, completely. You know, when I came to Budapest for the first time 32, 33 years ago, the world at that point was going through a huge transition. And this seemed to be the most exciting place in the world to be, really, because Hungary felt like it was the frontier of a whole new world. As the Cold War collapsed, as the Soviet Union collapsed, and as all of these countries of Central Europe embraced democracy and the market economy. And of course, we had already seen in the Asia Pacific, we had already seen the great success stories of the rising Asian economies, and we'd seen how a combination of investment and trade and openness to economic liberalisation had been a great success. And so we expected to see the same here. Of course, the politics in this part of the world is very different from the politics in Asia, but the world was changing then. And I think there were a couple of things that people in the West in particular believed at that point, and I would count myself amongst those, although I had a slightly different perspective coming from the Asia Pacific than people who came from Europe or America. But the West generally believed that it had won, a big battle of ideas with the Soviet Union. And I think America in particular felt that it had won the Cold War. And there was a belief at the time that there was an inevitability about the world becoming more and more like the West. Now, of course, as someone from the Asia Pacific, I'd never quite believed that the world would become like the West. However, I did believe that there was great opportunity, as I'd seen in my own part of the world, from economic liberalisation. And I'm also a great believer in democracy, where it grows domestically and where it makes sense domestically. But I'm not a believer that you can impose democracy. So, of course, the world changed a lot over those 30 years because I think America believed it could impose democracy and could lead the world to look like it. And unfortunately, that didn't work. And of course, the things that did work, the liberalisation of trade and of investment that led to the massive growth of Asia, has now brought us to this point where I think we're at another tipping point, another inflection point, where I fear that the West no longer believes that it's winning, but now is afraid that it's losing. And I think this is leading us to a whole lot of new anxieties, new fears, and makes it a very interesting time indeed.
And because you mentioned that the rising power of the Asia-Pacific, I think we should move our conversation towards a big actor within this Asia-Pacific reign, which is China. And as you know, the Chinese Communist Party is currently holding its 20th National Congress, and there was a huge emphasis on its military enlargement. And how do you think this will affect Taiwan particularly and other regional actors as well?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of issues to unpack in that question, aren't there? China definitely is the big one. But I would argue China is, while it is the biggest player in the Asia-Pacific region, it is following in many respects the same path that other countries of the region have taken, whether it is Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and the other countries of Southeast Asia as well, and that is that it has used its marketization process, its opening to the world, to drive economic growth. And so I'm not sure that I agree with the premise of your question that the focus of this party congress has been all about the military. I think actually the one major focus is economic growth, and I think we're hearing still that economic growth is the fundamental priority for China. However, of course, they're hitting very difficult times at the moment. There are a lot of stresses and strains in the Chinese economy. On the other hand, the point in your question that is correct, of course, is that there is a priority as well on national security. And there are two parts to this. Firstly is the defensive part of it, that I think the Chinese leadership are thoroughly convinced now that the United States is trying to prevent their rise. This is something that Chinese elites had said to me over many decades of my visits and the times that I've worked in China. It's been a common refrain for a long time. Oh, you guys in the West will try and stop us from rising. And I always used to say, no, we won't, because we welcome your economic growth. But of course, the Chinese leadership is today totally convinced that the United States is out to get it. Whether that's right or wrong, that is their perception. And so on the defensive side, yes, they are desperately now trying to build what they consider to be their defences. Now, of course, then there's the question of Taiwan, and this is where how you characterise defence is a matter of perspective, right? It depends on where you sit, because, of course, Taiwan, meanwhile, has been there for 70 years, claimed by China, and Taiwan claiming to be China as well. So the unresolved civil war of China. And there's no doubt that a more powerful China today would like to achieve its long-cherished dream of resolving that civil war and absorbing Taiwan back into China. And there's no doubt that many people in Taiwan do not want that. I believe the vast majority want the status quo, which we'd all, I think, dearly like, is to try and hold a status quo as we've had for 70 years with Taiwan. But whether the time is coming that China will test its strength or be provoked into doing so, for example, if Taiwan declared independence, that would be the kind of provocation that I think would lead to conflict. So dangerous times, definitely.
So definitely any conflict should be avoided there. But moving on to moving more into China as well, how satisfied do you think the Chinese are with the current structure of the international order, particularly with the global liberal order that has been placed upon it?
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to my earlier comment about where the West was 30 years ago, because I think the United States and more broadly other actors in the West, if you like, did believe that it was inevitable that the world would want to become more and more like the West. And so this talk about a liberal international order was always the hope rather than the reality, I think. I think there is a liberal order that exists in I don't know, 20 or 30 countries. My home country, Australia, would be one of those countries that do have a thoroughly liberal democratic system of government. But the vast majority of the world doesn't live in a liberal order at all. And so from a Chinese perspective, China as a rising power and as a developing country looks at the world quite differently from those a couple of dozen countries that are in a liberal democratic order. China looks at the world and says, hey, you know, we're the second biggest economy. Why do you guys not allow us to have an equal seat at the table in the IMF or the World Bank? Why is the US levying all these trade sanctions on us and blocking our technological rise? So it's a question of perspective, because on the other side, of course, the US says, hey, why are you guys stealing our technology? And you know, why are we not benefiting? And why are you benefiting from a level playing field in trade? So there are definitely different perspectives here. And so China has prospered and has benefited enormously from joining the World Trade Organization. It appears to date to be deeply committed to the multilateral system. It's a country that participates very strongly in the United Nations system in peacekeeping. It's the biggest contributor to peacekeeping. It's set up its own international organizations. So it's an active player in multilateralism, but what it doesn't want is to play second fiddle. It wants to be a leading player. And so in those areas where it's given a secondary role, like in the international financial system, that I think is where it definitely wants to shake things up and wants to play a bigger role, and has started to innovate, which is, of course, threatening to the United States, which is used to having control of the financial system.
And since we're on the topic, can I ask your opinion if China is willing to cooperate with other actors in the global governance in such a deteriorating, might be a little bit a big word, but I would say more intense international environment?
Oh, I think deteriorating is absolutely the right word to use. I mean, I think we're in a very dangerous moment in the world order, because we do have a rising power that is, as I just discussed, is challenging some aspects of the current order. And we have a reigning world power, the United States, which has overwhelming power, but is feeling very threatened and is using very harsh sanctions against China to try and hold China back, as the Chinese see it. And it's important to understand how each side sees things, because otherwise we'll misdiagnose the problem. So the problem is deep, because both sides see the other as a rival, as an enemy, if you like, which is a very strong word, but increasingly, I think, as they're taking provocative actions against each other, it is a deteriorating world environment. How does China act in this situation? Well, I think China is acting the way any country would, and that is it's trying to build supporters, it's trying to build relationships. It doesn't pursue the usual traditional Western style of building alliances. It's traditionally been opposed to that. Of course, we might remember 100 years or more ago, the United States used to be opposed to alliances as well, and it changed its mind. So who knows the future for China? But to date, China doesn't tend to like military alliances, but what it does do is it invests deeply in building relationships with other countries, building deep economic interdependence. And we've seen that through this Belt and Road Initiative. It's just emblematic, it's symbolic of the way that China builds very deep economic and then political and cultural connectivity with other countries, in the belief, I think, that by building such deep integration and interdependence, that China will then have friends, sustainable friends for the future. Now, whether that works, who knows? We'll have to see.
Thank you for that. Another area of concern, which is highly relevant at the moment, regards to the energy crisis in Europe. Do you think that further solidarity between European states or a possible disintegration of the Union could occur from our current times?
Well, they are very dangerous times, and the Russian aggression against Ukraine has put us in a deep crisis situation in Europe, obviously, and the dependence of some countries on Russian oil puts those countries into a dependent position, there's no doubt, and it's a very challenging tension that exists there, because countries need their energy supplies, but equally The countries of the West are very united in wanting to stand firm against Russian aggression. So it has created a real crisis. I don't think, on my reading of things, that this will weaken the European Union or NATO. In fact, I think the reverse. I think that the Russian aggression has strengthened the NATO alliance in particular, but I think also the European Union is muscling up. It's an organization that for decades has largely been focused on an economic integration process. There's been a level of ideology around it, that it was around deepening and strengthening liberal democracy as well. I don't deny that, but I think it primarily has been an economic project, and the political and ideological elements have been added on, especially after the end of the Cold War. And it's never developed a clear and coherent role as a geopolitical actor. And if anything, I think this current crisis is pushing it in that direction rather than to separate. But it is early days, and who knows the future. It really does underline how uncertain these times are that we're living in.
And perhaps we all been to experience the situation here in Europe, because we're right here in the center of Budapest. And perhaps we've been currently under expression of energy crisis. And perhaps because of that, what lessons can Asia learn from the energy crisis that currently plaguing Europe?
I think Asia is in a different position. I mean, I say that as an Australian. Australia is one of the big energy suppliers to Asia. Australia's probably unlikely to place countries into a position of dependency, but who knows in the future. That may not be the view of China, for example. I mean, I think China worries about its dependency on Australia for critical supplies. China is very dependent on Australia, and that could well be one of the reasons why it is busy diversifying its sources of supply for energy and resources. But I think the situation in Asia is very different from the situation in Europe. I don't think there's any comparison. Russia clearly is a very aggressive actor, and any reading of Russian history would show us that any dependency on Russia is a highly dangerous position to put yourself in. In Asia, our experience with modern China is a very different one. I mean, China is a deeply integrated, interdependent economy. And however, having said that, the deepening ideological direction that Xi Jinping has taken China in, and some of the frankly counterproductive sanctions that China has placed on some countries to punish them for taking positions on issues has been very disappointing. I mean, it demonstrates that actually China is copying the United States. It's copying the kind of behaviour that the United States uses to sanction countries, to go around the rules of the World Trade Organization, and to punish countries for political reasons. This is something perhaps the Chinese are looking at the United States and thinking, well, this is what a major power does. We'd better do it too. I think it's very disappointing, because I think actually the strength of the Asia-Pacific region for the last decades has been that actually we've built an architecture, if you like, of economic interdependence, of openness, a regional openness in the Asia-Pacific to trade and investment. And if any country comes in and starts to throw its weight around and break the rules, that's going to deeply concern people. And so I think some of this behaviour from China is deeply concerning, but I think we do have to put it into its perspective, that it doesn't fit the pattern of the way that China has acted for the last decades. So is it a new direction that Xi Jinping wants to take China in, or is it a reaction to provocation? These things, I think, we need to think through and we need to examine over time.
Yes, and I've also noticed that one of your main areas of focus is regarding climate change and the green economy, for example. With the recent economic hardships and situations that is plaguing Europe and Asia, for example, China bringing more coal plants online, and Europeans generally trying to find more energy sources, how do you think the current economic instability and political instability could affect the global climate security environment?
I think in the short term, yes, we're seeing that most countries around the world are looking to their traditional supplies of energy in the current crisis, but I think also all countries are looking to the transition that they need to make, because almost all countries in the world have made commitments, serious binding commitments now, to shift to renewable energy and to reach a net zero position by around the mid-century. Now, in China's case, they've given themselves an extra decade. They're saying by 2060. But interestingly, they're talking about reaching peak coal by 2030. And so it means in the next decade, we'll see the transition occurring quite rapidly in China. China has a massive investment, the biggest in the world, in renewables. And China has told us, and to date the evidence is that they are acting on this promise that they will not invest in any new coal plants outside of China. Now, of course, inside, as you say, there's still quite a lot of coal development. So this is bad news for the environment. It's good news for countries like Australia that are supplying that coal, unfortunately. And this is the problem, you know, that there's economics bound up in these questions. But we've got to make the transition, and leaders everywhere know this, including in China. And the transition is a very important one to move the world in the next decade or two towards a green economy, and certainly by mid-century to have reached net zero. And that means not just renewable power, but it means shifting to green transport, like we're seeing here in Hungary, all of this investment in electric vehicles and the batteries for electric vehicles. This is the technology of the future. And I think it's very interesting to see, in fact, very worrying probably to the competitors of China, that China is really staking a leadership position in this transition to electric vehicles, for example. When you look at those big investments here in Hungary by Chinese companies, they're investing in this area because I think there's a deliberate plan here to be the dominant player, to be the Germany, if you like, of the future with the premium electric vehicles. And so it'll be very interesting to see if that happens or if China's just one of a number of players in the future. But I wouldn't be looking at Chinese auto manufacturers any longer as second rate. I'd be looking at them as aiming to be the future leaders, and that's a really important part of the green transition.
From what we've spoken so far, do you perceive interdependence as either a source of stability or more or less a vector of vulnerability?
Well, interdependence has been the source of great stability for decades. And so it's been those people, those leaders who are tearing it down, who've created the problems of today. Interdependence means that you negotiate, you talk. Excuse me. Interdependence means that you find a balance of interests between different parties, between different countries. And that means that if one country has a strength in one area, but another country has another strength, the two economies find a way to balance that and to benefit from it. It cannot be called interdependence if it's not mutually beneficial. If one country is benefiting, then it's obviously a relationship of dependence. But interdependence is a very accurate way to describe the way that the global economy developed over the last few decades. We saw in the Asia-Pacific region this massive growth of a middle class of about 1 billion people because of the integration of the Asian economies into the global economy. And this equalized the world. This created much more equality in the world and much more interdependence between different economies. Now, it isn't seen that way in the United States, because the United States no longer has such a dominant role. So naturally, it's feeling threatened by this change. And so my interpretation of this then is that the Donald Trumps of the world, who want to tear down this interdependence and who want to return to a dog-eat-dog, you know, fight over who's boss, this kind of mentality, this geopolitical mentality that life is a struggle and it's like a chessboard where, you know, one side wins and the other side loses, this takes us back to the dangers of war and to completely forgetting the lessons of the peace that we've had in the last decades, which were built from interdependence. But sadly, I think leaders around the world are following the example that Donald Trump set. And as we see more and more countries, we saw during COVID, we saw governments all over the world failing to cooperate, failing to work together. And we even saw countries that were blocking supplies of medical equipment. India, for example, you know, I mean, countries that you would not expect to act in such a destructive way, but barriers being put up even in relation to human health and human lives. So we seem to be in a period where interdependence is under attack. Interdependence is no longer fashionable. And this is a highly dangerous situation when all the evidence is that interdependence worked very well for the world, including the United States, actually, which, you know, what went wrong in the United States was that the governments, successive governments of both sides, have not invested in building the United States infrastructure, in maintaining their middle class. You've seen this huge growth of inequality. You've seen the destruction of manufacturing jobs, largely from technology, but not replaced with new industries. So you've seen a domestic governance failure that's being blamed by the Donald Trumps of the world on international trade. It's really not as a result of international trade. The US is still, the US doesn't even need very much international trade, but the rest of us, we do.
On the opposite spectrum, there's still a wide array of areas wherein cooperation is possible, as you've said, and maybe what we want to do is to focus in on this cooperation. What do you think soft power diplomacy, what its roles are in this cooperation?
Soft power is this fascinating term that Joseph Nye invented, but of course it's always been around. I mean, we just call it by different names, but public diplomacy or whatever it is, the power of narratives, the power of storytelling, we are all influenced by the stories and narratives of different cultures and different countries and different leaders as well. And I think the 20th century was no doubt the century of the United States, where so many of us around the world were really enraptured and inspired by a story. You know, it didn't mean there weren't individual things that were not so great about the United States, but overall the big picture was a very attractive one. You know, the United States stood for freedom, for the ability of a migrant to arrive with a suitcase and $5 in their hand and they could become a millionaire. This dream of being able to make it as an individual, no matter what your background, so free of any kind of discrimination, none of which was probably very accurate, but it was a great story. It was a really powerful story. And so I think America had this enormous soft power, you know, rock and roll and Hollywood and jazz and so many things about American culture and the American story that built upon the great soft power and attractiveness of European cultures from earlier centuries as well. Now, of course, the critical theorists would say this was built upon imperialism, that, you know, that we adore these European cultures because Europeans colonized the world and we were taught to adore them. Well, of course, there's some truth in that as well, we have to concede, because, of course, there are many attractive, wonderfully inspiring things about other civilizations, about other cultures all around the world. And it's not only Western culture that has soft power. There is soft power, the potential for other civilizations as well, but it hasn't been as effectively utilized, perhaps because it hasn't been combined with geopolitical power. And this is where China will be a very interesting one to watch, because it does now have power, because it is now the second biggest economy in the world. So it has the power to spend money. And so we're seeing a lot of money being spent in China on what it believes will foster soft power. Lots of Chinese news being broadcast around the world. I'm not sure who's listening to it, though. Lots of Confucius Institutes teaching us Chinese and teaching us Tai Chi and things like that. But I'm not sure that it's very effective yet. Whether it will be in 100 years' time, people will look back and say, well, the 21st century became the century of the Chinese idea. I don't know. I think some elites in China hope so. I'm not so convinced. I think actually soft power cannot just be manufactured. It cannot just be bought. It has to actually be earned, and it has to come from real innovation and a real story that grabs people and inspires people. And there are things about China that are very positive. China has raised the greatest number of people out of poverty into a middle-class existence in human history. So there is a very good story to be told. But of course, at the same time, there are some pretty evil and nasty things going on in Xinjiang, and you know, human rights abuses and other things that we see around, and even extending beyond China's borders, we see activities that are the activities of an authoritarian system that are not attractive to those people outside of China. They're not attractive to people even within Taiwan, which is right next door to China. So this is a problem for China. If China wishes to have soft power, it needs to look at itself. It needs to look at how it acts and whether that's attractive to the rest of us or not. And I would argue at this point in history, overwhelmingly, that the behaviour of the Chinese government in human rights terms is very unattractive. However, its economic success story, it has to be said, has been very successful. So there's a mixed story, but it's not a compelling one yet. It's nothing like the American story, which, you know, we forgive America for some of the mistakes it's made, some of the big mistakes it's made, some of the flaws in American society today. We all still have this enormous goodwill. We want America to fix it. Well, China needs the world to have some goodwill towards it as well to fix its problems. And I fear that there isn't much goodwill towards China. In fact, there's quite a strong anti-China feeling in much of the world, which I don't agree with. I mean, I think we should criticize actions of the Chinese government when they do things that we disagree with. But to be anti-China, I think, is very unhelpful. But it is definitely there as a phenomenon in the world, and it's there as something that's being fostered, sadly, by those same people who are trying to undermine interdependence and peaceful cooperation.
We really appreciate your input. That was some very nice insights. But I think also the podcast focuses on youth career opportunities as well. So I would like to ask about your work. What does the work of a vice chair of the UN Asia Pacific Sustainable Network entails?
Well, I was a diplomat for a long time, and I was also a senior political advisor, held various political roles as well in Australia. And so I'm at a point in my life where I'm giving back. And so this role that I have with the United Nations in the Asia Pacific is a voluntary role. It's not a job. It's a role where we have a group of business leaders from across the region. We meet regularly, and we have developed a platform of activities. So we have a number of task forces fostering green development and encouraging sustainable development projects. And we've also come up with an idea to promote a Green Deal for the Asia Pacific. We want to build upon the fact that the Asia Pacific has been so successful in its economic development the last few decades, so successful indeed that it's now really the hub of the world economy. But if we are to reach net zero, if we are to actually prevent catastrophic climate change, we're going to need a green transition to happen in the Asia Pacific and fast. So the kind of commitment that we're seeing in Europe, which is wonderful, is not yet replicated in Asia, because Asia is poorer and has a greater need for further economic growth and development. And as we were saying before, if your priority is economic growth, like China's is, for example, well, you're going to be doubling down on coal for the moment rather than replacing it as fast as you can. And so we believe that we need to foster a speeding up of this green transition, to work with the kinds of companies that are doing that, that are innovating, and to champion them, and to try and encourage governments as well to collaborate and to cooperate and to work together. We're pretty good at that in the Asia Pacific region. There's often a discourse, a narrative in the West about Asia that I think misses a big portion of the Asian experience, and that is that we are pretty good at cooperating. We have huge differences between us in every kind of way you can imagine, political, economic, cultural. We're the most diverse region in the world in the Asia Pacific, but we actually have managed to build deep economic interdependence. We've been able to sustain peace. There are a few exceptions, and there are some deep problems in a few areas in the Asia Pacific, very deep problems. But generally, for most of the population of the Asia Pacific, which is billions of people, life is much better today than it was 10 or 20 years ago. And so there's a great success story to be told, and we believe that our region of the Asia Pacific can replicate that success with the green transition and can actually be a leader in technological innovation and transformation into, if we were the manufacturing powerhouse of the world, we need to be the green powerhouse of the world. And I do believe this will happen, but it is going to take us a couple of decades to make this transition. But the faster we do it, the safer our environment's going to be.
And before we're wrapping up this podcast, is there anything else you would like to share with our young audience? Perhaps youth action, impartiality in changing world order, or career-wise?
I guess you're probably taken from my comments that I really do believe in keeping an open mind, in not rushing to condemn one side or the other, although, of course, I've had a few words to say about some leaders. But in terms of countries, in terms of cultures, let's not demonize one or the other. You know, even if we think they're making mistakes, and let's face it, I think almost everyone is making serious mistakes at the moment. I suppose that is my takeaway, that I'm sad to say I think many mistakes are being made at the moment everywhere. So my advice is, don't believe everything that you hear. If you're hearing that one side is at fault for everything, it's highly unlikely to be true. It's much more likely that mistakes are being made everywhere. The second, I think, important lesson from that, if you maintain your open mind and your skepticism about narratives, is to actually observe the complexity of the world. The world is a very complicated machine, if you like. It's totally actually unpredictable and is so complex that to rush to simplistic answers is probably going to be wrong. Any engineer will tell you that if you are trying to manage a complex system, you have to have a system of management that is just as complex to mirror the complexity of the system. Well, that means our brains are actually pretty complex instruments, but we don't tend to use them in a complex enough way to try and assess the environment we're in. So keep an open mind, be aware of complexity. And I think in terms of career, no matter what your dream is, I think if you pursue that, if you are open and you're aware of diversity and complexity, you will find opportunities and you will stand out, because it's not the norm to actually embrace uncertainty and diversity and challenges and opportunities. The norm is to close and to think in a very simplistic way. So I encourage people, keep your education, keep thinking, always stay learning. Here am I approaching 60 and I'm back doing a PhD and I am loving it, and it's the best thing I ever did. I think we should never stop learning.
Well, that's true.
60 is still young. Mr. Morris, thank you so much for making the time today and elaborating on your insights of the shifting world order. Dear listeners, we arrived at the end of this week's podcast, in which we had the pleasure to discuss a point of view of Mr. David Morris, while also diving into the subtleties of diplomacy and foreign affairs. My name is Antonio Paolo Cuyo, and I had the pleasure to co-host this episode with Simon Lee. Thank you for being with us, and stay tuned for the upcoming episodes.
International Diplomatic Student Association is a Hungary-based organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSA podcast aims to educate listeners on career opportunities for university students in Hungary, opening their minds to current socio-political issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPA Radio.